The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to this episode of the Michelle Tafoya Podcast. Harvard, Princeton, Penn, MIT, once pillars of academia, are now being looked at with a little bit of question in people's minds because of the agendas in the administration, in the corporate boards that run them. So what do we think people are being taught in the classes at these institutions? And when it comes down to history, it's hard to believe that history could be manipulated and shaped to be taught in a way that, I don't know, makes you hate your own country. But it seems that that is what's been going on here in America over several decades, probably longer. Jack Henneman is our guest coming up. He is a former attorney and healthcare executive turned historian. He's also on the board of directors of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, an organization we promote proudly here on this podcast. He has found a way to teach history in a podcast that is so accessible, so listenable, so interesting, so well-researched, and I dare say unbiased. This guy needs to be heard. And so I highly recommend you listen to him. Now, we're going to start off with an excerpt of one of his podcasts where he quotes from a JFK speech from 1946, just to give you a little flavor of what he delivers. And then we'll get in deep with Jack Henneman about history, about today, and how we're talking about American history, and how the future might look back on all of this. It's going to be, I can already tell you, it is fascinating. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Michelle Tafoya Podcast.
Conceived in Grecian thought, strengthened by Christian morality, and stamped indelibly into American political philosophy, the right of the individual against the state is the keystone of our Constitution. Each man is free. He is free in thought. He is free in expression. He is free in worship.
Well, that is from one of your episodes surrounding a speech by JFK. Welcome, Jack. I'm so glad to have you here. And it's been really interesting to dip into your podcast and listen. But it makes me think of a lot of questions that a guy like you, very accomplished, very sought after, obviously on the board of directors of FIRE, which we're a big fan of. What made you want to do this? It's almost as though you're teaching a history class every episode.
Well, thank you first for having me on. It's an honor. The idea really came to me as a pandemic project. I sort of work part-time doing consulting and such. My wife was very busy. She's a psychotherapist. And by the time September rolled around, I wanted to visit my mother in Charlottesville, Virginia. I live in Austin, Texas. So I swabbed up and drove to Charlottesville and visited my mom. And then I went on a three-week pandemic drive about September 2020 in October, listened to podcasts, sort of reported this to my Facebook friends, and a law school roommate turned me on to David Crowther's History of England podcast, which is very detailed and is now 12 years along. And I listened to 30 or 40 episodes and wondered if anyone had done a similar thing for the Americans. And really no one had. There's obviously a lot of history podcasts, but they bounce around. They don't sort of do this sort of granular progression that I'm doing. I really did it as something to do. Taught myself everything. It's still completely, I do it all myself. I don't have a helpful producer. It sort of took off. And then I gotten a lot of sort of positive feedback, and now it's the funnest thing I do. And I, you know, love the new community that I've sort of built up around it.
I would imagine one of the most fun parts would be the research, the studying for every episode, because that to me sounds like an exploratory journey where you're learning something new all the time. How far back did you start? In other words, it's called the History of the Americans. At what point do you think the History of the Americans begins?
Well, that's obviously a subject one can argue about. And in fact, when I got back and started October 2020, sort of conceptualizing the whole thing, I started by reading two or three books on Jamestown and two or three books on Plymouth. And then I realized I was doing it wrong, that there was this whole phase of exploration by the Spanish that included the Narvaez expedition, Soto, Coronado, and so forth in the 1500s. And they covered a huge part of the country. And then I realized, well, wait a minute, there were people here first. And that sounds silly, but I had to sort of break out of my own assumptions. Like most of us, we were shaped by our schooling. And so I opened it up with two episodes on the indigenous peoples before Columbus. And then I, from there, did, I think, four or five episodes on Columbus, because if you don't talk about him, it's very hard to understand everything that comes after it. So even though the only place in the U.S. he touched was Puerto Rico, you still have to really engage with it.
That part of it is fascinating, because Columbus has been made to be such a villain in America. Columbus Day has all but been canceled. Do you think we have that right or wrong these days? One of the things you say is presenting history without presentism. In other words, you know, the lens of everything we know now, you're trying to just present it as it happened. So what do we have right and what do we have wrong about Columbus, do you think?
Well, it depends who we is, I think. Look,
okay,
Columbus was a remarkable and deeply flawed person. He had an innovative idea. It was essentially a high-risk venture that he pitched, much as a tech startup would, you know, seek funding today. He really had a pitch deck, and he shopped it around the monarchs of Europe. And really, at the last minute, Isabella took it up on the theory that it was Columbus was probably wrong, but it was a worthwhile speculation. He was a natural seaman. He had capabilities at sea, not just sailing to the west, but coming back in a very arduous journey. And remember, if he didn't get back, he wouldn't have discovered anything, because he would have perished.
Right.
He was a terrible colonial administrator, and was personally insecure, and he was hard to like. And he initiated slavery in Hispaniola to mine gold. And so there's an awful lot one can criticize about Columbus, on the one hand. On the other hand, as an act of inspiration, courage, and vision, it was quite something. And, you know, my view of history and the importance of history is that it teaches what Greg Lukianoff, who you had on recently, would call epistemic humility. It teaches us how much we don't know. If the great people in history have huge strengths and huge weaknesses, so do we all. And I think that just as people who idolize Columbus or anyone else are sort of too certain of their views, I also think in many cases, today's critics are also too certain of their views. They tend to seize upon, one trait or one thing they did and conclude that that condemns them. Well, we're all likely to be equally guilty of something horrible if judged from the distance of a couple of centuries.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
which is what I love about your view of all of this. And I think it gets so lost in today's discussions about history that people can do great things and still have flaws, but they still did great things. And we could pick them out today if we wanted to. I'm sure we could find great flaws and people have found them in Steve Jobs and, whomever you want to find them in. It doesn't deny an accomplishment. So is that kind of what you mean by eliminating presentism?
Well, it's that is a aspect of that. Presentism really means sort of what it sounds like, the application of today's morality or philosophical thinking or point of view to moments, events, people, decisions in the past. Mm-hmm. And, there's a lot that could be argued about that. You can't eliminate it entirely. We are ourselves trapped by how we're raised and what we've learned. So I've now sometimes say there's no intentional presentism. We all do our best. But I think that the famous historian's expression, and I don't know who said it first, the past is another country. And it is as perhaps unwise to try to judge the past any more than you would judge some completely different country. And one of the things that I find strange today is, a lot of our schools, we will denounce figures from our past, but we would never denounce some current leader from, Nigeria or Colombia or Iran in the same terms. And yet our own past is just as alien, if not more so, as, other countries of the world that we'd be much more reticent about criticizing.
How do you think, Columbus, we can move ahead to the founding of the United States, et cetera. These figures were painted and drawn and quoted on paper and in print. And now we have all of the technology, and we have for some time, to have recordings, to have video, to have all of these things and some way terrifying deepfakes. But if we just were to rely on the accuracy of today's technology, I think it's so easy for people today to envision a George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, and almost an animated cartoon drawing in their high school history book sort of way, and to take them less seriously as real humans because they don't necessarily have, photograph proving this person or... I don't know if I'm making this clear, but today you can look back now and you can see video of John F. Kennedy, and you can hear his voice and all of those things. How much of a difference do you think, this is a little kind of, I'm asking for your judgment here, but how much different do you think that gives the perspective of those differing generations?
Well, that's a very interesting topic. I think that video conveys a lot of information that we don't, video and recordings convey a lot of information that it's very hard to extract from documents. That's got to be the case. There's probably something deceptive about that too. It's easy for us to think we know somebody better than we would have without that stuff. Do we know, just to be bipartisan about it, do we know really very much about Barack Obama or Donald Trump? We think we do, but do we? I don't know. I think I'm extremely humble in my own ability to make these assessments. So, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see as the era in which we have sound and video for our national leaders, national heroes, especially in large quantity, as that lengthens. I think understanding how that influences our perceptions of them will be a very interesting project.
Yeah, I think so as well. I find it seems very easy for people to tear down statues of people that they don't really see as human. And, you know, they see them almost as a caricature. And they, again, judge them for the flaws. They apply presentism, et cetera. And I think that's just been a really tragic development in this country. But that's go ahead. You want
to
say something?
If I may opine, I think,
yes.
The statues are a complicated topic. I would say in many cases, my objection to taking them down is less political than it is that I think it's a lost opportunity. I think that in many cases, the statue creates an opportunity to shape a new narrative and to have that conversation around it. Mm-hmm. And that when you take the statue down, the focal point for the conversation goes away and people are less likely to learn. On the other hand, a lot of these statues were put up for presentist reasons, if you will. So for example, a lot of the statues that celebrate heroes of the Confederacy didn't go up in the decades after the Civil War. They went up two generations later, really as an attempt to reframe our national perception of that war. So they were put up for a political reason. And now they're coming down for a political reason. And I struggle with that. I'm not big on tearing them down, but I have a hard time criticizing them. This whole effort is, of course, moved to places which I think are extremely troubling for our national memory. Removing Thomas Jefferson is really different than removing, in my opinion, Jefferson Davis. I mean, in my mind, you know, there's a big difference between those two. And I think in today's world, it's hard to have a discussion about, you know, where that line ought to be and the nuances that ought to be taken into account.
That's an extremely good point. I'm having you on to opine, so I appreciate it when you do. One of the things that came to mind when I knew I was going to be talking with you and discussing American history is this, in the last several years, the 1619 Project comes on, the New York Times platforming this, as a way to reframe the founding of this country to a time when the first slaves were brought here. The woman who authored it is not willing to debate, it seems. Many people have tried and offered to say, let's discuss this, let's debate it. And debate, as we've seen, is hardly happening anywhere in a real sense anymore, which is equally as tragic as just pulling statues down or just deciding that one person is evil and that they can't have any good about them or vice versa. What did you make of that, of the New York Times platforming that idea and of the fact that she doesn't want to discuss it with anyone? She doesn't want to put her thoughts, her ideas, her beliefs to the test.
Well, the New York Times, New York Times will be the New York Times. The 1619 Project, I think, has a whole bunch of different elements to it, as I understand it. And I'm not a student of it. I've read a bunch of the critiques. I've not read the big, thick book of all the essays. I want to be very clear about that.
Sure.
I think it is one thing and a good thing to elevate a lot of the scholarship that's been done in the last 50 years to understand the history of enslaved peoples in this country. Mm-hmm. And it's really been going on a long time in academic circles, and a lot of it's really good. There is, for example, been a huge project, and I'm going to not quite remember the exact name of it, so apologies to the scholars involved, but to pour through 17th, 18th, and 19th century shipping records and build a massive database of where enslaved peoples were captured, how they were transported on what ships, to what places, and where they went. And this has been a massive effort that's told us a tremendous amount about the history of slavery in the Western Hemisphere, not just in the United States. I think that's awesome. I think that a lot of the work that's been done to understand this is great. And I think the New York Times, in elevating a bunch of that, so it's more it's more widely understood at a popular level, it's fine. They then did something else, which I don't agree with, obviously, which is they wanted to, in the elevation of all of this excellent information, excellent scholarship, use it to entirely reframe how Americans look at their country. And it wasn't just in the stuff they wrote in the New York Times for their readership, but they built a whole elementary school curriculum around it and took it upon themselves to weaponize this scholarship for a particular political objective. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that that is very destructive of the point of history. I think, as I said, a great value of history is that it teaches epistemic humility. Well, the problem is politics is about precisely the opposite. It's about epistemic confidence or even arrogance. You know, people in politics and partisans online and all the rest are just so darn certain of their point of view, okay, that they will assert it even in the face of evidence. And my guess is that Hannah Nicole Jones is one such person, and the people who want to debate her in many cases are also that way. I think, therefore, that the value in these kinds of debates are often, it's often suspect. I think we really have to recover our old habits of talking to each other. I don't want to lump you in with me, but I think people roughly our age have a shot at doing that. But we have to break ourselves, again, an opinion of this modern idea that what we want to do is own the other guys. Much rather have a conversation with them and figure out what we can agree on.
It's so interesting that you use that term own. I want to own you. I was ambushed on a particular podcast, and when they put out the social media clips, you know, so-and-so torches, so-and-so schools, so-and-so blasts, so-and-so, you know, just so in other words, it's one side versus the other. And there wasn't a conversation. It was someone just sledgehammering the other person to make their own points. And there can only be one winner. There cannot be conversation and debate. There has to be a winner and not just a loser, but a demolished, imploded mind. You know, this person's opinion is just absolutely flattened. And that kind of rhetoric has just been soaring in the press. And of course, social media has exacerbated that. But it's I've noticed that so much lately that, you know, all of those verbs, torched, you know, schooled, just, you know, all of it. You know what I'm talking about. I'm
yes.
Losing track of the words, but it is really interesting. And I think you raise a beautiful point. And that is that as certain as Nicole Hannah-Jones is, the opposite person would be. You're right. How do you think? Because you seem to have some confidence that we can learn or adjust and get back to talking to each other. What's the first step?
Well, I think that serious people who want to actually have an exchange of views rather than score an immediate political point or social media moment, you know, there's things we could do, I think, to make that better. So, for example, if two people on the opposite sides of the 1619 Project wanted to have a debate, maybe a way to do it would be to have it in private as a conversation and have a transcript and release the transcript a month later.
Yeah.
And have people digest that, yeah. You know, and potentially learn from it. Each in that context, one-on-one. I mean, I have friends who are my age from college who are jerks and an exchange on Facebook, but you know, you're sitting around with them having a beer and you have a complete, you know, turns out you've got about 40% common ground on the
issue.
Absolutely.
And it's
a completely different thing. So I think, you know, there's a lot of fretting about quote our democracy. And I think that the most important thing we can do to protect our democracy is actually figure out how to have open-minded conversations with each other again. And that may require rebuilding a little bit using new mechanisms because we don't trust each other in an age of social media and video. So we need to rebuild trust. And there's ways to do that, I think.
That's, you know, when you were talking about, I hate to bounce around here, but when you were talking about Christopher Columbus and how visionary and brave and, you know, the risk taking that he undertook to do what he did. And yet he was flawed. I wonder how history will look back on someone like Mark Zuckerberg, who was a visionary, who came up with this amazing Facebook, Meta, all these. But there's been damage done by social media. We haven't even begun to see the damage done by social media. I wonder if decades, generations from now, Mark Zuckerberg will be held in some kind of presentism of the future where they say, how could he not have seen how damaging social media might be? Now, I'm not saying he's responsible for all of it, but he built the platforms. He built the original town square where people could just throw stones.
Well, you see this, happening with industrial entrepreneurs of 100 years ago, right? I mean, Henry Ford is an example. Okay. And Henry Ford was an awful anti-Semite. We know that now. Probably knew it then if we were paying super close attention. And he unleashed, he basically made the automobile possible for ordinary people. Mm-hmm. And that has been extraordinary. Now, at least in some circles, the view is, well, maybe the automobile, the mass use of automobiles has been really destructive in ways that put us at risk. Not my point of view. I'm just saying that it's a perception that's taken hold. So leaving aside Ford's personal defects that made him somebody you wouldn't necessarily want as a role model in some ways, his legacy in business may be looked upon very differently even in 30 years than it was 30 years ago.
It's interesting. I think there are a number of industries we could look to and say that, and certainly a number of leaders we could look at, and we'll dissect opinion after opinion and decision after decision as the years go by and decide we feel differently about it 25 years from now than we did at the time that it happened. This is the issue. The other question I have for you regarding history, because I think it's so difficult now for people to trust academia, as we've seen recently, to trust that they are actually teaching history as it happened rather than teaching history the way that they want you to learn it. And that's why I find your podcast really, really engaging and interesting and something I can sink my teeth into, because it doesn't seem to me you come to it with an agenda except to expose it and to give it a place and to allow people to listen. So this is really an interesting, I wonder if it's the wave that we can't trust academia to really educate people, I think, in the ways that are, that teach them to how to think. They teach them what to think. What do you think?
Well, I should say, I'm a long way from being a university student. I think it's easy to, and I find myself doing it, like yakking with my wife. I'll make some comment about academia, but it's really a lot more complicated than that, including among historians. And you see this with real age differentials. Historians my age and older tend to be much more old school in their approach. And as is the case sort of across various fields, the younger professionals tend to be more politicized. And, maybe there's a reaction to that coming in the next generation that's rising up. I have some feeling that may be the case. What I do think is happening, and I sort of a couple episodes back, I have a editorial sidebar that tackles this point, is that historians who tie their scholarship to a political objective today, mm-hmm, are doing exactly that. They are spending the coin of institutional credibility that was built up over a long time by academics who probably did bring political views to class, but tried not to make that the purpose of what they were doing. Nobody is entirely free from that. Academics today who say, listen to me, I'm a professional in the field, I'm an academic, and this is how this this thing in the past relates to politics today, mm-hmm, are, I think, damaging their own institution's credibility in ways that, we've seen across other institutions in recent times. I'd probably give away some of my point of view on the topic by suggesting that the public health people during the pandemic just passed, to some degree, spent the coin of objectivity or public confidence that had been built up over generations by becoming too partisan and too specifically political in their policy responses, recommendations.
It's a great point. I have a final notion to discuss with you. I have a friend who, in her email signature, quotes Jablonski by saying, "Data don't lie." I can take raw data and say, yes, 2 + 2 = 4. That's no lie. But data can be manipulated to form a particular narrative. Would you agree with that?
Well, I mean, in all kinds of situations, you know, financial information in the hands of a good financial analyst can be characterized to show a company is doing well or less well. That's the case with history. You know, part of the practice of history is arguing about the importance or relevance or weight that should be put on a given piece of evidence. And, you know, this is a huge part of what I would call the more sophisticated argument over the 1619 Project. Okay. There are pieces of evidence, and I'm not going to sort of explore it in detail, partly because I don't know it well enough to sound really competent on the point. But I do know that you know, the 1619 Project and the scholars who back it put a lot more weight on certain, I'll say, moments of evidence, documents, bits of evidence, than the scholars who say, no, look, there's always an example. Yes, there were people who had the thought that, you know, it would be easier to preserve the institution of slavery, you know, if the United States were independent from Great Britain. Sure. Okay. The question is, does one guy offering that in a diary entry mean that it was truly a reason?
Right.
You know? And there were more pieces of evidence than that kind of thing. I don't mean to suggest, I'm not trying to disparage either side. I'm just saying the weight one puts on that sort of thing is really important. And today there's going to be a huge amount of it. You know, how many emails are sent by a White House? Well, future historians will be arguing over, you know, which ones were super decisive. And I hope they do it without having a political axe to grind. It's said that it takes 50 years to write a good history of a presidency because they can't be written by people who were taken up by the political passions of the moment. So maybe the best history of the Trump presidency is going to be written by somebody who's 10 years old right now, you know. And that's part of the reason you need somebody with distance to put some weight on the different elements.
This is so fascinating. I could talk to you for hours. But the beauty is that people can listen to you for hours. The podcast is The History of the Americans, and you can find it everywhere. And you can follow him on X, formerly Twitter, and many places. Jack Hanneman, it's been a real treat. I'd love to have you back because so many of your episodes, there was an episode on Thanksgiving I was listening to that raised so many questions and queries in my mind. And it's a wonderful, wonderful listen. And I hope people will go find it. The History of the Americans podcast. He is Jack Hanneman. Thank you, Hanneman. Thank you. I have a good friend named Hanneman. Thank you for taking the time. I genuinely appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your kind words. Very much appreciated. It's a labor of love.
You're very fortunate to be able to do that. It's a beautiful thing. People, go check it out. This one's worth it. My son said to me last night, "Mom, there are so many podcasts." And I said, "Yeah, I know that, son. I've got one." And he said, "But they're just, everyone's got a podcast." But fortunately, now and then we roll upon one that we find that is useful, that is listenable, and that is worth your time. And this is one of them. So, Jack, thanks for joining us. Everyone, don't, as I always say at the end of every podcast, be brave, do good, go out there in the world today and do something that takes a little courage and something that maybe makes a stranger smile. And we will see you next time.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.